Okay, thank you very much to organizer for letting me inviting you to give a review, an overview of the bottom-up approach, which I spent a lot of my time. So we just saw examples of the top-down approach. This is an anonymous slide from a donor to the field. And however, so we just heard about this, and there was also the traditional bottom-down approach, which was basically saying, okay, let's forget about string theory, but let's consider scalar fields with kinetic energy, potential, let's try to understand better the potential. So I think this is, was the status until a few years ago. Now I will present what I've considered a truly bottom-up approach, which is really the approach that is trying to understand really what we're really probing with the data, what is really our understanding of the theory. Let's look back in 1 second at how we probe inflation. So the only observable that is really testing the background of the inflationary solution is in some sense omega k, which is bounded by to be 3 to the minus 3. All the rest of the observable comes from the fluctuations. We know from this beautiful plot of the Planck that they are primordial, super Hubble, that they are scale invariant, they have a tilt, and S minus 1 is measured to be minus 4.4 times minus 2, which is the right order of magnitude that's predicted by inflation, which is one over the number of refoldings of duration of inflation. And the fluctuations are quite Gaussian. The skewness of distribution is less than 10 to the minus 3. Now, of all these ones, there are only two numbers that are needed to fit this beautiful curve. This number here and the amplitude of the scale invariant part of the spectrum. All the rest are something qualitative or bounds. Is this enough for you to buy slow-down inflation or even inflation itself? Maybe. And now we even get anomalies. So, So I think we need a more essential description. An essential description that will allow us to really state what we are really learning from the data and what is really assumed. In doing so, since you try to be very general, you will also explore all possible signatures. And also allows us to know what we're really swallowing when we say it is slow-down inflation. In other words, how to get confidence that slow-down inflation is what happened, even in the absence of additional information or detections. To do that, we have to link to observations. And the only thing we're testing are the fluctuations, so we have to link to fluctuations. So let's review 1 second what happens in particle physics. When we, or in physics actually in general, when we are probing a system at an energy scale E, we need to describe the system only with the degrees of freedom that are accessible up to that energy. Effects of inaccessible physics are encoded in a few higher dimension operators that we call irrelevant because they are irrelevant. We change the description, but it's a technical name. We change the description only when new degrees of freedom become accessible and therefore relevant. In inflation, fluctuations are of order Hubble, redshift a bit, and freeze. So all the fluctuations live at energy scales of order Hubble. The background field, phi dot is rho all, which is this quantity, if you use what zeta is a 10 to the 5 Hubble square. So it's much bigger than Hubble square. For what I just said, this means that to describe observation, the background is not needed because it has much higher energy than the fluctuation. In fact, you can build an effective theory for the fluctuation like this one, symbolically, where there will be some fluctuations, pi, with some kinetic term and some higher dimension operator, down by some scale. This scale is called the unitarity bound. Because these theories are not renormalizable. They're not, quantum mechanics breaks at energy of order lambda u. Something therefore needs to happen by then. By testing the interaction of this theory, or the absence, you can put limits on this upper bound, or this unitarity bound. And for example, just an example, you could conclude that the unitarity bound could be bigger than this scale here, h dot m plus square, which is the Schrödinger scale. So if you were able to conclude this from the theory of the fluctuation, which is what you are testing, then we would know that Schrödinger is an allowed unit completion of the theory, Schrödinger inflation, Schrödinger unit completion of the theory from the observation. And this, it's also, this would be even still an assumption, because it's not guaranteed that this is the one day of completion, but at least you would be able to do the link from data. So what we have now, as I will show, is that this cutoff, this bound, this unitary bound, is of order at least as large as 10 to the 4 h squared, which is still quite smaller than 10 to the 5 h. So this means that from data, we don't really know that inflationary background is driven by scalar field. We will never know, because we will never reach those energies. But even from the data, there is no, we don't really know yet. Okay, there is, this energy scale is not, we don't have, we haven't tested the data so well that to say that the effective theory is allowed to go to such energies. We only know now that inflation, whatever it is a weak coupled field theory, because the cutoff, the unitary bound is bigger than Hubble. And let me remind you that fluctuating scalars doesn't mean fundamental scalars. As you change the energies, the correct description of physics can change radically. Let me just give you an example. This Lagrangian, it's always the same Lagrangian, because it was written by Weinberg, it's always the same. This describes the Carrel-Lagrangian of pions in particle physics, that are the Gustav boson of SU2 cross SU2 broken to the diagonal group SU2. This is a very nice scalar field Lagrangian, easy UV completion, a scalar field with a maximal net potential. Since this is SU2 cross SU2, you need the 4-6 scalar field. You broke it to the diagonal. Fantastic, we have the UV completion. Wrong because the theory, there is no really fundamental scalar field. When we went to high energies with the accelerator, which has 1 GeV energy, QCD was found to be the right UV completion of this theory. And there is no scalar field in QCD, but this pi field is an emerging scalar field, which is the condensate of 2 quarks, 2 fermions. Another example is the standard model with W masses, with gauge boson with masses. And now you can realize that the longitudinal polarization of this Gustav boson are described by the same Lagrangian, again, of a scalar field with some interaction which is related to Mw over G. Why this is possible is called Gustav boson equivalence theorem. And this Lagrangian is not UV complete, because this operator is irrelevant, dimension more than 4. And one possible UV completion is an X scalar field, which will unitarize the W boson scattering. But another good UV completion was Technicolor, which doesn't have another scalar at all. Higgs was correct this time, but he was lucky in a sense. That is, the Higgs particle could have not been the right UV completion, it could have been something else. And in fact, people now is thinking that they study the possibility that the Higgs is a composite, okay? So what is fundamental is really relative. You can describe only really with confidence the physics at your energy scale. Ah, okay, good, thank you, good. Yes, perfect example, yes, thank you. Okay, let me skip this slide because So we're testing fluctuation. So what is, we have to connect observation, we need to go to the fluctuation. What is the general theory of the fluctuations? And this is called the effective field theory of inflation, or you can say the other way, which is inflation really as the theory of a Gustav boson. So in order to build this effective theory, you have to think in inflation in very general terms, which here I will take the point of view that there is a physical clock driving inflation and determine that the sitter phase, that is inflation, to end. This is really it's a very general point of view on inflation. And this means that there is a peripheral spatial slicing on this in the sitter space-time, where this physical clock, whatever it is taken to be uniform. For example, if it was a scalar field, but again, doesn't need to be a scalar field, fundamental scalar field, this would correspond to the gauge delta phi equals 0. Now, when you are in this gauge, you build up the Lagrangian with all the fluctuations that are left. And since the physical clock is homogeneous, the only fluctuations are the metric fluctuations. And you can build only invariant operator compatible with the symmetries of the slicing, which is time-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms. This is a very large symmetry group, which will have consequences. And in fact, you can show that the most generic Lagrangian has the following form, with fluctuations on the metric linear, quadratic, cubic, and so on and so forth. So this is pretty complicated still. But then you can realize that this Lagrangian is the Lagrangian of a spontaneously broken K symmetry, The Gassimi to be spontaneous broke is time translation. So you can reintroduce the Gauston boson, then the linear realizes this symmetry, and use the Gauston boson equivalence theorem to forget about the metric fluctuation and just keep the Gauston boson. The technical procedure is something called Tucker-Bert trick. You perform the diffeomorphism that is broken, which means here is a time diffeomorphism. So G00, for example, transforms like this. I forgot. And you see that this Lagrangian contains many terms which are not four-dimensional diff invariants. It's only three-dimensional diff invariant. G00, for example, is an allowed operator. When you perform a diff, it transforms. But then you say that pi is a field that shifts under time diffeomorphisms like this. And therefore, it's a Gauston boson because it shifts under time diffeomorphisms. And in particular, if you are at high energies, and in inflation we are at energies over the Hubble, which are high in general, then you can neglect all the metric fluctuation and concentrate on this action. So now the action, I claim, is quite simple. This pi is like a scalar field. You can think of it as the fluctuation of the inflaton, delta phi. But here, there is no inflaton. We didn't assume it. So, and this is the Lagrangian. In fact, this construction is analogous to the Carrier Lagrangian that I've been showing from the beginning of inflation of the talk. And in fact, this comparison actually was given to me by Weinberg itself, so which I take as a great honor. So this Lagrangian was used by the WMAP team and the Planck papers, and I really thank them because I think it's a great satisfaction, and I think it's good that they do it, but they attributed it to Weinberg. Now, Weinberg is great, he's my hero, and I think he should deserve two Nobel Prizes, not just one because of the cosmological cost, huh? But this is not due to Weinberg, okay? This is not due to Weinberg. It's true that Weinberg is the father of all of us, but okay, he doesn't need it. But let me just come back to the Lagrangian. And notice that they concentrate on this part, but there is more to the Lagrangian. In fact, even in the slide they called Galilean inflation, for example, the Galilean inflation was this, and it was already done. So let me guide you a bit through this Lagrangian. Which is the mother, actually, of all inflationary model, okay? It's not just one, it's all the inflationary models are really UV completion of this Lagrangian. For example, these are two kinetic terms, special kinetic terms, pi dot. There are two coefficients here. You see that some of the coefficients are proportional to the background H dot or H, but then there are other coefficients. Then there is a kinetic term, special kinetic term. And then there is also another kinetic term with a higher derivative, special kinetic term. And so the generic dispersionation is something like this, with a speed of sound, which doesn't need to be close to one, over one, Lorentz invariant is broken, and higher spatial gradients. But then there are also interactions. There are these three operators in leading order, and many others that come from the dot dot dots. In a derivative expansion, and also in a number of fluctuation expansion. Okay, let's draw some lessons that we learned from the Fetti theory. First, the tilt. So this Lagrangian is fine to make all predictions of inflation. Okay, all what we're testing comes from this Lagrangian. So for example, the tilt is really how much the history of the universe changes as the very smalls cross the horizon. So there is a m plus square h dot that changes, a h changes. So the tilt is h dot over h, h double dot over h dot, cs dot over cs h. So this is the tilt. The tilt is not really, unfortunately or fortunately, we don't know that the tilt is the slope of the potential or the secondary of the potential. This is an assumption. That when we do this plot, and we put these values here, it's fair, it's fine, but it's an assumption. So we should remember that what we're really testing and what we know is this, how much Hubble changes with time and the H dot changes with time. So this as a caveat, it's an assumption. Another thing that we learn is that inflation is technically natural. That is, this Lagrangian has several operators, but you notice that all of them have derivatives on it. Operator without derivatives appear if they come really from the fact that from the time dependence of the coefficients that once you do the Stugobert trick become h of t plus pi, and when you tell expand you get h double dot pi square. So this would be a mass term. But you see the mass term is proportional to the Sroll parameter. So there is a small parameter protecting the relevant operator. In particular there is a Xi symmetry in the limit of no Sroll parameter that protects this operator. The only other operators are irrelevant operators, dimension more than four, like this one. Once you canonically normalize, you can recognize the field, and you call the lambda unitarity what is downstairs. For example, in this case, it becomes cs to the fifth h dot n plus square. It's a scale, and this tells that this operator is irrelevantly small. And this is, means that this theory has only irrelevant operator, and the relevant operator are small because of a symmetry. It's softly broken symmetry. And this is exactly as natural as the theory of pions of particle physics. This is, if you open the Pulcinski review on effective theory, this is the definition of a technical and natural theory, because quantum corrections are small, are very small. So we learned that inflation is not tuned. What is tuned are some UV completion of the theory. But the effective theory is not tuned. And in particular, you can find, indeed we found, UV completion which are non-tuned. So tuning is a problem of the UV completion, not of the effective theory. Another thing that we learn is that there can be large non-Gaussianities, and they're technically natural. That is, you can see that there are some operators that can be large, and whose coefficient is much larger than h dot, because it's h dot n plus square. So they can be large without ruining inflation. So this, for example, this three set of operators can be large, and their smallness is not related to being close to the Sitter space. In particular, they're irrelevant operators, so again, they can be large and there is no problem. This is, I think, one of the lessons of the effective theory, because it's the demystification of non-Gaussianities. Non-Gaussianities, it took 25 years since the beginning of inflation. Inflation is not really predicting tiny non-Gaussianities. The real fair prediction of inflation is that the non-Gaussianities are small, because the theory must be weakly coupled at double scale. But we don't know how small the non-Gaussianities is. In particular, these operators are actually beginning to be constrained by the data. In particular, the effective theory automatically gives you the size of the operator. For example, you can canonically normalize the fields. And this is very simple, because you see, oh, this operator here, I canonically normalize, and I get this thing. So the amount of non-Gaussianity is the importance of this operator at the energy scale which I'm probing the system, which is Hubble. So since the operator is 1 over lambda u square, lambda unitarity square, the effect of the operator will be a square over lambda u square. As for every dimension 6 operator that we do. So smallness on non-Gaussianity just means that Hubble is smaller than lambda by some amount. But this tells that can be large non-Gaussianities, and actually when you combine all the operators, you get all possible shapes between these, for example, and these. And I think by now we know very well, but seeing these things in the sky would be a tremendous achievement, because the amount of information that there is in this function, these are not just two numbers, these are functions with infinite numbers, that tilt, tops, half, maximum, minima, slopes, it's incredible, okay? In fact, it's the same information seen in a 2-2-2 scattering in the sky. It's like, so with this, really, you could prove inflation. What I said at the beginning, we are not sure about inflation. With this, we will be very confident. Another lesson is symmetries. As typical in effective theory, symmetries are exploited the most. So, since time-deformed physics are non-linearly realized, every block, every fluctuation must come in a block that it's invariant under this symmetry. For example, one block is the standard kinetic term of the fluctuation, but another block is just a time kinetic term plus interactions. Now you see that if you put this block, you can change the relative signs between di pi square and pi dot square, which means that the speed of sound of the fluctuation is changing. But if you want to set this operator large, you have to put also this interaction, because they come in a block. And this means that there will be large non-Gaussianities, and the non-Gaussianities turn out to be 1 over C squared. And this is a theorem. The smaller is the speed of sound, the bigger is the non-Gaussianities, just from this block nature of the symmetry. And now this has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's just a consequence of Lorentz invariance. Another thing that you can realize is that there are many, many, many consistency conditions that you can write. For example, because of the block structure, if we have small CS, we must see this. But if we see this, we must then see this four-point function. So with infinite data, if we detected this, that unfortunately we didn't yet, we should detect also this. This is a verifiable consistency condition. For those of you familiar, there are other consistency conditions which are unverifiable. That is, they're only deniable, like these ones. So which these are different consistency conditions than the one I just told that is verifiable, because this consists, for example, you can notice that all the signals that come from single field inflation are very small in the so-called squeeze limit, the triangle, where one of the modes is much shorter than the other. This comes from the fact that it's related to the effective theory of inflation, because when we go to the gauge where the clock is taken to be uniform, then all the fluctuations of the clock are by construction in the metric. And since they're in the metric, you can write them as the rescaling, local rescaling of the scale factor. Now, when a mode becomes very, very long, its gradients are negligible, and the only, by general relativity, the only things that are observable of this mode are the derivative, the Laplace and the time derivative. And this has led, this means that it's locally unobservable, and this means that when you compute the correlation function between a long mode and two short modes, in practice there is no correlation function. And this means that this led to a series of falsifiable, but never verifiable consistency conditions, because they tell you that there should be no correlation between a long mode and short mode. So if you see a correlation, you have a problem. And again, it's related to the diff invariance on the slices of the clock. Another lesson that we learn is that it's consistent to a W less than minus one. So yesterday we heard, for example, the name fundamental dark energy is not consistent. And however, please, let's not call it phantom, because for a long time, these are theories which are a ghost. And because we know it's bad, I know the phantom is a very common name, but people change the name to phantom, but it's not that changing the name makes the theory consistent. And it was an open problem for a while, but then in this setup, which I'm not going to explain, we found the way to find W less than minus one consistent, but only with this kind of theory, okay? And this tells you that an effective field theory, knowledge condition, can be violated, and maybe it's not violated by some deep UV reason, but in the low energy in the quantum field theory, it's okay. And please, if you can, change name. It's okay. W less than minus one dark energy. So now there are models that can do it. So it's allowed parameter space. So this was very nice, and we were living a nice life. And then, and especially after December with the WMAP result, I was very happy. And then Planck came. As you know very well, they didn't find any detection. But they used this effective Lagrangian to say that what we are learning from absence of detection about this the effective theory about inflation, and they draw these counter plots, and these are really the counter plots of a fundamental Lagrangian, because thanks to the effective theory now we have a Lagrangian, so you can map all what you are observing into parameters. In fact, I think this is a qualitative new and superior way of using cosmological data, because this is for you, if you are interested in fundamental physics, this is what you want to know, and now we have this matching with the parameters, and in particular, this is very similar to what happens, for example, in particle physics with the precision electrophoric test. For example, there is a very nice universal limit that the speed of sound or the adiabatic mode must be bigger than 2 times 10 to the minus 2. And I think this is fantastic because it's very privileged that we're able to say anything about inflation. We always complain, but it's very privileged that we can say something. And this is a true fact on nature that we know now. In fact, I'm very happy because for a long time I was going around and saying, oh, we should do this plot, we should do this plot. They made them, thank you very much. But also, if you change page, there are also other plots that you can do, because as I said, there are also the other lines of the effective theory. For example, this is related to Galileo, for example, but it was already, then these are other parameter space, other. So the phenomenology is a bit richer, and you can do them without effort. It's just the same thing. But I think it's richer, and it represents really what we're learning. There are several islands of parameter space that are allowed, not just this one. But if you concentrate on this one, which is okay, we see that the size of this operator means that absence of detection means that there's a bound on the cutoff, and what we're learning is that the cutoff is bigger than 10 to the 2 Hubble. So we have these bounds on the cutoff. And so what has Planck done to non-Gaussianities? Which I remember you is one of the leading tests, one of the two leading tests about inflation. So let's look, let's step back and look at LHC. LHC was it's a very nice experiment because it has two thresholds for detections, and this is awesome. By unitarity of double scattering, you knew that the unitary scattering breaks down below a TV. So you knew that something must come in before a TV, and in particular, the Higgs field, since it's a weakly coupled UV completion, will come way below the TV. So you were, by a factor of the weak coupling cost, so you were guaranteed the discovery of something. Then, even more, there was a second threshold, because if the Higgs was found, then immediately you have a tuning problem, because the Higgs receives quantum correction over the Higgs mass itself. So you better find other new physics immediately, or you have to change your principle of theoretical physics. Naturalism is no more good. So with LSC, or SSC would have been even better, there is a huge learning guaranteed, because one TV is a threshold for two physical principles. In non-Gaussianities, we are not in such a lucky situation. We don't have a threshold. That is, we would like to have a threshold to say that the unitarity bound must be smaller than something, so that FNL is bigger than something. But we don't have a compelling threshold. In fact, after 25 years, we were able to make non-Gaussianities a decent, an interesting observational field, but we are not able to make it a guaranteed detection. In fact, we have actually a lower bound on the unitarity bound, which is Hubble, and this translates in a bound that FNL must be less than 10 to the minus 10 to the 5, which is over clearly satisfied. And this was actually, the real prediction of inflation was that FNL should have been less than 10 to the 5, and in that sense, this is satisfied. Now, there is a minimum size of non-Gaussianity which came from Mandelson, which comes from the mixing with gravity, which you cannot shut down this interaction, and this gives an FNL 10 to the minus 2, which is 3 order of magnitude below Planck. So is there another threshold, at least? So a threshold, another interesting threshold is FNL equilateral of order 1. Because in this case, the cutoff is of order the through roll speed. So if, or the inflator, so if we were able to exclude or to get to these bounds, we would say, okay, the cutoff is as high as the speed of the inflator. So one of the possible decompletion is clearly allowed by the data, not just by our aesthetic or theoretical prejudice, but allowed by the data would be the through roll inflationary field. But this is more than a factor of 10 away. In fact, the non-Gaussianity in Planck improved respect to WMAP by a factor of 3. And since the non-Gaussianity goes like 1 over lambda square, the minimum cutoff from Planck is a factor of 2 larger than the one in WMAP. Given the absence of any theoretical threshold that we have, a factor of 2 is really not much. So Planck is great, but Planck is really not good enough. And this is not Planck's fault, not the Planck's people's fault, it's nature's fault. So don't complain with the Planck people, complain with nature. In fact, but Planck really was for us an opportunity of a detection. But there is not, it's not really much of an opportunity to change the theory in absence of detection. From the theory, nothing, unfortunately, really nothing changed. On the theory side, little change. This is, for example, quantity LHC. The absence of detection in LHC of something beyond the Higgs is changing radically the way we think of physics beyond the standard model. Are we done with Planck? So are we done with Planck? And I think not, actually, because if you look better at the effective theory, you can find many higher derivative operators that are technically natural and can give large non-Gaussianities that are frequent functions, for example, that are completely orthogonal in order one fraction of the parameter space to the one analyzed so far. And this could be 20 sigma in Planck. And nobody has looked for it. We have been looking for it for a while. And hopefully soon sometime will be done. But even more important, I think there are four-point functions. For example, this four-point function is the only one that can come in single clock inflation. This could be the leading signal. Again, this is very, very weakly constraints. And this has a huge information, because while the three-point function is two-parameter space, the four-point function is five-dimensional space. It's even fantastic. Instead of 2-2-2 scatter, it's like a 2-2-4, something like that. It's fantastic. Any of this discovery, and even though we're working on that very slowly, but I should say that any of these results would change completely the Planck press conference. This is important stuff, I think. So what about additional fields? We know that there are, can be additional fields in inflation. There are two kinds of additional fields. If they are converted to curvature perturbation at times, well, then you can build an effective theory including them. And what I want to say is that okay, there are many new shape of non-Gaussianities that can be predicted from the multi-field sector that cannot be done in the single field sector, and these are all basically non-constrained. Okay, so nobody analyzes this is something that should be done, and we have been in progress for a long time. So, but it's important, I think. And then there are other models where the field sector is, as we had before, is hidden, and let me just skip it. I don't have time. But another, I stress the importance of threshold. And there is another threshold in multi-field, which happens when you have late time curvature conversion to curvature. If you have additional fields that convert at late times, the relation between curvature perturbation sigma, the additional field, is local in space. And there will be its own power law, but everything will be weighted by an epsilon efficiency. How much is the efficiency of the conversion? For example, you could say how much affects the fluctuation affect the duration of inflation, how much affects the change of the equation of state. If you work out the algebra, you find that the FNL local is one goes like 1 over the efficiency. And since the efficiency bigger than 1 is hard, it's impossible, you have that FNL local should be bigger than 1. You can get less than 1 by engineering cancellation, but there is a threshold for multi-field inflation, which is FNL local is 1. This is not a theorem, but it's really a gut feeling threshold, okay? It's really something that is there. So if FNL local less than 1 is ruled out, this would be something that we should target for it. So this is, I just gave an overview. It's a developing phenomenology, and there are many young people working on this, not many older, so please be nice with them. And maybe it's becoming mainstream. So last 4 minutes, I'll say the following. So we saw that the theoretical threshold that we have are FNL of order 1, and they're quite far from Planck. So how are we done for cosmology? I mean, in ESA, people said these words, so let's. I think not. I think if you say this question, you have to answer no. What is next? The next thing is going to be large-scale structures. Apart Planck will increase by a factor of 2 with polarization, and maybe this will be surprising, will be a surprising discovery. But next after Planck is large-scale structure. And for us, we'll be moving like a LEP to LHC, from a leptonic collider to an hadronic collider. Much more powerful, but much more noisy. So there are some people that have some forecasts. The next big mission will be Euclid. And the improvement on non-Gaussian will be a factor of 2.5 also with respect to Planck. And in order to do the estimate, they use a maximum wind number, a sort of Lmax maximum, which is 0.15 inverse megaparsec, because they say at some point the linear theory deviates from the nonlinear theory, and that we don't know how to make any prediction more. So what I claim is that the theory that made this theoretical line, I believe is wrong. And this has led me and some others to develop the effective field theory of cosmological large scale structure, because it's part of the bottom-up approach, not only to be able to understand what I'm learning from the data, but also get sure that we are able to understand as well as possible the data. Because the experimentalists are great, and the theorists should be exploit all what they do, all what they give us. So this part is like going from beyond the standard model physics that I talked so far to doing sophisticated calculation perturbative QCD. So let's look at the universe. Okay, yes, perfect. So let's look at the universe. The universe, let's remind ourselves of the Carré Lagrangian, which is the Lagrangian I've been writing since the beginning of the talk. The Carré Lagrangian describe the quantum physics of the pions from low energy around their mass, which is 100 MeV, and their interaction becomes stronger, stronger, stronger until the nonlinear scale, which is 1 GeV, when they become quantum strong coupling. So there is a range of energy where the pions physics is perturbed, as you describe with the Lagrangian. But the universe is exactly like that. Because if you look at the universe at large distances, delta rho over rho is very small, so there is a perturbed spatial, but as you go to shorter and shorter distances, the universe becomes more and more delta rho becomes grow, and at some point, when you reach the ultraviolet energy of 10 megaparsec, the theory breaks down, is strongly coupled. So the only difference is that instead of being quantum strongly coupled, becomes classically strongly coupled. So once you realize this, you're done, because you realize that you can write an effective fluid description with higher derivative terms, all in an expansion in wind number of the wind number associated with the nonlinear scale. I claim that this is the correct theory to make prediction for large structure. And this is a preliminary results of our 2.5 loops calculation. So now you have to use loops, counterterm, renormalization, matching, the same language that we used in particle physics. Now it's used to the universe with a UV cutoff scale of 10 megaparsecs. So it's pretty a different, unusual setup. But what we are finding is that our predictions are okay with the nonlinear simulations, and this is a plot of percent range up to a K max of 0.5. So Kmax 0.5 is pretty high. It's much higher than the one that we're using to make this forecast, which was 0.15. And since the non-Gaussianity goes like Kmax, the constraints go like Kmax to the 3/2 because the three-dimensional service, this is a factor of 6, which means that the improvement that Euclid can do on Planck is not 2.5, it's 15 on FNL. And this is good. This is a lot. It's like from Planck to double map square, from double map to Planck square. With an improvement of 15, what you could do? You could really have FNL local over the 1, which is, again, we basically ruled out in our theory space at least local non-Gaussian multi-field inflation. You can get FNL equilateral or orthogonal of order 5, which is a CS of order 1, close to 1. This means that this scale that would push, allows us to infer about, from low energy, about low roll, would be there. We've almost practically made it. And most importantly, though these are very nice things, we will get a very big shot at detection. Okay, it's another factor of 15, which of course is revolutionary. And with this, also DES and that gets would do better than Planck. So this is the potential, a factor of 15, if not more, because this, again, this can be, we're just starting with this. However, I think we're not done with this, because the problem of the Hermite classic, I think, is being successfully addressed by the effective theory of logical structure. But there are many astro problems that are to be addressed on top of this. Hollow bias, Galilei bias, non-local bias, fingers gold, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not sure if I forgot some et cetera. But it's clearly that there is a lot to understand. But what our calculation shows is that the dark matter has a lot of information. And this is what is at stake. It's a factor of 15 in our knowledge of the non-Gaussianities, okay, which is erasing the cutoff by 15 squared. So, and then this is not a job done, but this is a challenge for all of us who are doing logical structure. So this is the conclusion. So thank you, Planck, and thank you, the Planck team. The universe, and we never say, but the universe is understandable and so very beautiful. But what we are really learning about inflation? Well, the initial perturbation is super Hubble and the tilt is perfect. You can be happy with this, you can be not so happy about this. The effective theory of inflation really allows us to talk about what is relevant in a technical sense. Let's forget about all the relevant parts. So is there something that could be beyond? B-modes will improve. This is great, we have not seen them. Non-Gaussianities, they will really improve again inflation. These are not seen them yet, and they really could have shown up. We should say they could have shown up. But unfortunately, we didn't reach the threshold that are really would really tell us really a lot. And but we are still learning something because we are constraining the couplings. Any universal statement that you can make on the speed of sound of the adiabatic mode is just, I think, fantastic. But now I think we have to move on. And the large-scale structure servers offer a great window of potential improvement. How much information is there to extract for us? It's a possible factor of 15. So the answer is if we can, and it's, I think, at the time of the theories to see if we can. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Thanks for a very interesting talk. Question?
It's a comment. And a question, maybe. The comment is that it's what you say, getting factors of 15 better than Planck, is let's say is not trivial, okay? Because not trivial, okay? It's not only instrument related, okay? Because there are effects from structure formation which generate effects which contribute to an effective FNL, but not primordial, okay, from structure formation. And Planck has already seen that, okay? So getting beyond that threshold, so you're starting to be competing with physical effects other than primordial ones, okay, which generate a disturbance to what you want to find, okay? So don't be too optimistic.
I understand. Of course, the ones you're talking about are computable. Up to 0.5, they will be computable. Because the point is that we can make prediction until 0.5, and they're computable. So this you can just subtract. Or you can, Yes, okay. Since Italia, I'll tell you a story.
Okay, yeah, so
there was a guy called Carlo Rubbia who said, let's do a proton accelerator. And everybody says, no, come on. And then he made it and he got it. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this is easy and this is trivial, but also the Dark Matter problem, people will say, oh, how can you go 2.5? And it looks like the correct theory does it. So, I'm not saying it's solved, but the Dark Matter is there. Can we control the other
stuff? You have bias and you have to...
Yes, look, fine. Look, I have all this, etc. I'm totally covered. Astro problems, totally covered. It's true. QCD was a nightmare, especially it was a nightmare in 82, where they didn't have Monte Carlo methods, and they discovered the W boson at the proton-antiproton collider. So it's true, but we are on scales larger than nonlinear scale. Are we sure we cannot do it? The Dark Matter problem, I don't think was addressed sufficiently well. I think this addresses well. We have to see the other problems. I think this is a stimulus for all. I'm not claiming that it's done, but I think this is an opportunity for the field.
I like a lot the effective field theory approach. In slow roll inflation with a scalar field, you get, of course, relatively clear statements about the coefficients in this theory. For example, small non-Gaussianities, sound speed close to one. I just wonder if in the effective field theory there is not a trace of that. That, you know, if you put these particular combinations of coefficients that are small in the slow field, in the slow roll approximation, do you not have an approximate symmetry or something like that, that, you know, where you find a trace of this particular set of models?
Yeah, I don't know of a symmetry that is announced in the slow roll limit. What is true is that the cutoff of all those operators that I mentioned is much higher. It's very high, it's M Planck or beyond. I mean, in fact, the leading cutoff comes from the interaction with gravity. But I'm not been able to identify a symmetry that is in the limit. I mean, yes, but it's also true that the if you take the Carol Lagrange and you bring the cutoff very large for a long time, it will look like a free theory. So in this sense, the slow inflation looks like a free theory. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. Bottom line, I don't know the answer.
I just had a clarification. So usually an effective theory is a momentum expansion in units of some cutoff.
Yeah.
If I understood, in your case, you said the cutoff to the fourth power was h dot m Planck squared.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
So in a situation where the Hubble constant is smaller than this cutoff, you might think, if you thought in conventional terms, that higher derivative terms, suppose the cutoff is of order the Hubble constant, which is, say, the string scale or something, then you might, in conventional terms, think all higher order terms would be important.
With the power. With the same hierarchy.
And
yes.
What I wanted to ask was, would you then not have to include arbitrarily high order terms?
Yes, but they're included in the dot dot dots. I mean, but frankly, if you have this h over lambda, the next one is very small. Okay, the higher derivative term is very small, so it's undetectable. So there are two cases. First, you do the derivative, you fix the number of fluctuation, which fixes the number of legs in the correlation function.
Yes.
And you do the derivative expansion for a fixed number of legs.
Yes.
And the higher derivative corrections are very small. Now, what we're working on is that we found a trick to make the leading derivative correction zero, technically, naturally.
Terms may not be small if the momenta are of order the cutoff. As in, for example, just to give you a concrete example, if inflation occurred at the string scale, you may not expect to have a local Lagrangian describing the expansion of small perturbations, the evolution of small perturbations.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, maybe we should talk
in
about
principle,
it. I want to understand.
Yeah, as you know, the higher derivative, this is a scene from the effective theory language, I think, in effect that higher derivative term don't renormalize the lower derivative term. Higher derivative terms,
yes.
Higher derivative terms don't renormalize lower derivative terms. The fact that if you do a loop of higher derivative operators, since the external leg have already the number of derivatives that you're talking about, you don't renormalize lower derivative operator. And so it's technically natural to have two different scales the unitary bound of the different operators can be very different. So you can have, it could be what you're saying, and it's also technically natural, that you can have a higher derivative operator with a unitary bound much smaller than the leading derivative operator, so become more important.
Okay, I think, maybe we can talk about it a little. I need to understand.
Yeah, but I think this is what you are saying. But this, okay, can be checked and looked for. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, so going back to the large scale structure, right?
Yes.
I guess I'll be addressing some of this on Friday. But the conversion, when you go to redshift space distortions, then things are much worse because the conversion from velocities from to the distance is a factor of 10 worse. Yes. So your nonlinear scale is a 10 times bigger now.
So I think
about galaxies, it's about the same factor. So it's really much more problematic than you're making it sound.
Yes, I repeat the example of before. It's true. For example, we can degrade to. I'm not really expert. You are incredibly more expert than me. So, but truly. But for example, we could downgrade it to the 2D survey, and still the improvement would be pretty large. Forget about redshift. I agree with you. The astro part is complicated, or the baryon part. Let's call the baryon part is complicated, but. It was very complicated also the metal part. So maybe we have 10 years to go.
So I just wanted to answer the earlier question about slow roll. Is there an enhanced symmetry? And the answer is there is. It's in the limit of exact slow roll, you get the full group of De Sitter symmetries.
Oh, yes.
So slow roll has some accidental special conformal transformations that are not there for a general slow roll model. So or for a general single field model. So there is an enhanced symmetry in the limit of slow roll.
Yes, I mean the symmetry is broken by. The symmetry is broken by the gravity side, so there is an hierarchy. Right, yeah. I think I made this statement somewhere. Yeah. Yes, yes. No, it's very natural. But all these theories are natural. Yes.
Higher symmetry, and this would still be natural because there is this in the background this higher symmetry. So it would be worthwhile to have also an effective theory, you know, in this language of this additional symmetry.
Well, this is what, for example, some people, including Weinberg, has written, and it's true. I had forgotten about this symmetry. That indeed, yes, it's there, and but the point of what I was trying to stress is that. All these models, all these coefficients are really natural, and they're equally natural. So it's not that that thing of slow roll buys you anything. It's not there is a problem with the other ones. In fact, you can find UV completion that will have this wing. For example, DBI inflation is as nice model as slow roll, and it has those couplings very, very, very small. So,
Right. So. Inflation ends at a scale where Hubble is probably like, you know, factor of two, not even, away from the scale at which you're inflating. So there is another
inflation
scale.
Inflation ends?
Yes.
Sorry?
Inflation ends eventually, like, you know, you have to stop inflating.
Yes.
Okay, and when it does, your Hubble is basically not even factor of two different when you're inflating. So there should be a lot of operators associated with this process. So where's R in your theory? And why they're not suppressed by like, you know, powers of 1 over 2 or like 1 over 1?
I mean, yeah, I think you can, yes. So you're asking about reheating, probably? Are you asking about reheating? Or, because, I mean, Hubble is taking account everywhere. So, okay, I don't have it there.
But I think if there's strong time dependence, you have more relevant operators.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's technically natural. Yes.
Yeah, that's
this
your point
what
you were talking
there
about.
There is a slide on that, yeah. Earlier. That there is a, it's possible, it is natural to have a small time dependence, which this factor of two is a very small time dependence. It's a tiny time dependence. Changing a factor of two in 60 Hubbles is a very small time dependence. So these operators are all at this one, for example. There are many operators proportional to the time derivative of Hubble, but they are very, very small, very not important. And you can include and you cannot. But these are then, in fact, we don't include them usually because they don't play any role really significant. But for example, this term is there. But then these terms are as important as the mixing with gravity. So, sorry,
I mean, writing it in terms of the pi is made an assumption. Writing it in terms of the pi's instead of the g
zero. This is often a there's no such an assumption, sorry.
Okay, you included the dot, 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 which is fine.
No, but also, I mean, these terms, if you look at the paper, are there. If you're interested in this term, they're there.
For example,
a nice thing that we exploited many of the ideas of Eva that came from string theory. We made the statement of what they mean from the effective theory point of view. One, for example, is the axiom monodromy, which in this context means really that this time, this Hubble has a time dependence, which is not really small, but oscillatory. So there is a discrete shift symmetry in Hubble, softly broken by the Sloup parameter. So, and we were able to make the effective theory of the symmetry, which was a derivation of, if you want, of axiom monodromy, but purely in the effective theory context, where exactly those terms were very important.
Good, okay. I think we agree. So, Dick had a question.
If you step back and look at both the theoretical landscape and the observational experimental landscape, and ask yourself, you know, if you were going after a detection of some signature of inflation, would you better off be looking for signatures of non-Gaussianity, or better off going after signatures of inflationary structures from gravitational waves? And I realize it's a very complex discussion, because ignore all the experimental difficulties and the backgrounds, et cetera, foregrounds. I just want to get your take on this, because, you know, are there classes of models in which you would see observable non-Gaussianity but not observable R, and vice versa?
Yeah, it's vice versa. They are both cases, and frankly, I'm not comfortable in choosing one with respect to the other. What I know, as a personal taste, is that if we detect gravitational waves, we will know something beautiful. We'll be a theoretical proof, really experimental proof of inflation, because the scale invariance of the tensor mode is really telling us about the Cita space. But beyond that, so it would be a major achievement, but beyond that, the only thing to do, I think, would be to find string theory model doing exploring fully the string theory landscape to know which are the models that give a large to the discussion or large of large tensor modes. From the phenomenological point of view, it wouldn't teach us much. It would give a scale for Hubble, and the Lagrangian would be we would still got a number, which is R, and that's it. So standard non-Gaussianities are much more exciting from the field theoretical point of view of phenomenology, I think, because they are to do with interactions. And what particle physics is usually all about is interactions. So LHC doesn't even start with a free theory. Instead, what we've been testing so far in inflation is the free theory. So it would be very exciting. If we see one of these operators, there is a challenge to recomplete them. It's an infinite amount of stuff to do. And also infinite amount of stuff to do experimentally, because not only you get the number, and once you get the number R, for example, you don't care anymore if it is 1%. I mean, the precision is kind of irrelevant. But here, for example, there is this operator, you really would like to know which are the operators, so you begin to study the shape of the non-Gaussianities. I mean, I think it would be incredibly rich, but both are fine, actually. I mean,
okay, well, let's thank both speakers again for a great session.